From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley, broadcasting today from KJZZ Studios in Tempe, Arizona.
I'm Robin Young. And Tanya, you will be circling the country before you land at your post in Los Angeles. Tri-hosting, I'm calling it.
That's
here now with Jeremy Hobson and me. So welcome.
Thank you. I like tri-hosting. It's like we're on a tandem bike or something.
Something. We'll figure it out. But to the news now. Oil prices spiked nearly 20% today after that weekend attack on the world's largest oil processing plant in Saudi Arabia. Houthi rebels in Yemen are claiming responsibility, but Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blames Iran. Iran denies that. Today, President Trump tweeted, "We'll see." Martin Patience is Middle East correspondent for the BBC. Martin, U.S. officials point to satellite images they say back up their claim that Iran was behind this, that the attacks came from the direction of Iran and not Yemen. But not everyone agrees with that analysis, do they?
Well, that's right. I mean, these images, according to unnamed U.S. officials, show that the attacks are likely to have come from the north and not the south. Now, that's significant because it suggests that attack was not carried out by the Houthis. They're in the south. But the U.S. has yet to say where it believed these attacks came from. There were suggestions that perhaps it was Iraq, although that's been ruled out by the U.S. Secretary of State. We had a statement from the Iraqi Prime Minister saying that his country was not the launching pad for these attacks. So that leaves possibly Iran itself. The U.S. Secretary of State has accused Iran of being behind the attacks. But interestingly, Donald Trump is saying we have to wait until Saudi Arabia weighs in the matter.
Yeah. And by the way, some who have seen the satellite pictures say that it's not that clear cut, that some of the damage appeared to be from the western side of the facilities, which would not be Iran or Iraq. But to President Trump's, what some may call caution, he did say that the U.S. was locked and loaded. And this is something that he said when Iran shot down a U.S. surveillance drone. Not only that the U.S. was locked and loaded, but the president said afterwards that he called off a strike 10 minutes before the strike because a general told him civilians would be killed. What's the feeling in the region, given that we've had this language before?
Well, I think that's the big point. I mean, the president does have previous on this, and that will be factored into anybody's response. But there's no doubt this is a region on edge. I think the big fear is that any military response, perhaps from America, perhaps from Saudi Arabia, could potentially trigger a wider conflict. So that's why everybody is very nervous indeed. I mean, this was a significant attack which took out a huge chunk of the global oil production. And I think the feeling is in the Middle East that Saudi Arabia and America will perhaps need to respond. How they respond is what everybody's waiting for. Although, again, interestingly, President Trump has tweeted that America isn't so reliant on Middle East oil, but they will, of course, support their ally Saudi Arabia. So the ball seems to be in Saudi Arabia's court for the moment, rather than Washington.
Yeah. And meanwhile, just to context, Iran has been suffering crippling sanctions, even though it was abiding by the nuclear deal. Saudi Arabia has been striking Yemen, which is embroiled in a terrible civil war. Some analysts are saying that Iran wants to disrupt the economy of its enemy states the way it has been disrupted. I mean, is that a part of this?
If Iran is responsible, and Iran has denied it, but I was recently in Iran, and the American sanctions on that country are really biting. People are hurting. The country hasn't been able to sell oil as easily as it once did because of the American embargo. If Iran was responsible for this attack, as some American officials seem to be suggesting, the message Iran, I think, is sending is this: if we can't sell our oil, then you're going to have to pay a price as well.
And just, you are such an expert in this region. You've told us this is perplexing to you.
Yeah, it is confusing. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors. There is a shadow war going on between the various sides, America on one side, Iran on the other side. The problem I think countries have got in the region is if, for example, Saudi Arabia comes out and says Iran carried out these attacks, well, Saudi Arabia then will be under enormous pressure to do something about it. Mm. Well, what will it do? A military response would probably invite a response from Iran, and then we could see a major escalation. It's interesting. Nobody in the region wants a war, and the reason they don't want a war is because I think everybody's worried about the potentially catastrophic consequences. And by the way, that includes Donald Trump. This is a man who pledged to bring American troops out of the Middle East. The last thing I think he wants to see is American soldiers being pulled back into the region once again.
Martin Patience, Middle East correspondent for the BBC. He's in Beirut. Martin, thank you.
Thank you.
UAW! Who are we?
UAW!
General Motors and the United Auto Workers Union say they have resumed contract negotiation talks. This as more than 49,000 members of the UAW walk the picket lines outside of General Motors factories in nine states. It's the first national strike by the UAW in more than a decade. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody joins us from the picket lines at GM's truck assembly plant in Flint, Michigan. And Steve, we can hear what's going on in the background. Describe what you're seeing there.
Well, there are hundreds of UAW workers standing at the entrances to the Flint assembly plant, and they're getting a lot of support from people who are driving by this morning, honking their horns. And the workers came out at midnight last night, and they've been on the picket line ever since.
Remind us, what are the union members asking for?
At this point, the union and the automaker are pretty far apart on a lot of different things, on pay and benefits. There's a lot of concern about health care costs being increased for union members. Job security is another major issue for the UAW. And also, there is a group of workers who are described as being temporary workers who they want to be made permanent GM workers. So that's all part of the negotiations right now.
Are the GM plants completely offline? Are any workers crossing the picket lines?
Well, the only workers crossing the picket lines at this point are non-union workers. That led to some scuffling this morning as some people started to show up for their security jobs and other jobs at the Flint assembly plant. But for the most part, the parking lot that I'm looking at right now, where usually it has thousands of cars of workers, is completely empty at this point.
Wow, I am familiar with that parking lot, so that's astounding. GM made a last-minute contract offer just hours before the contract expired at midnight. Can you tell us a little bit more about what it was and what union officials have said about that contract offer?
Well, the GM was offering to spend about $7 billion more on upgrading current facilities, employing an additional 5,000 workers, and was also offering about $8,000 in bonuses for individual workers for signing the new contract. At this point, the union maintains that it doesn't get to the basic needs that they have for pay, benefits, health care, and job security.
I did hear that the union vice president said perhaps if that offer had been made hours before or earlier, they might have been able to hammer out a deal before this strike went into effect. Do you think now that they're back at the table that we'll see a closing of this strike maybe sooner?
The expectation is that the union's ready to be out for a while. GM is probably, with its inventory, probably okay for at least the next few weeks until it starts having a pinch of not having enough vehicles to sell. So it's possible this could wrap up soon, or it could drag on for a while, just depending on what the two sides are willing to give.
And depending on that, that would impact production. Remind us, some GM employees gave up pay raises to help GM get through bankruptcy, but the company isn't bankrupt anymore. Is the company in a position to follow through with their promises to build electric cars and trucks and factories that are now closed or closing?
General Motors is in an interesting position right now. It made about $8 billion in profit in 2018, but the company is also in transition to producing more electric vehicles, to producing autonomous vehicles. So they maintain that in order to make the transition, they need to use make a lot of investments to do that. So how much of that, of the profit that the company has, will be available to increase pay for workers is, a difficult issue for them to resolve at the bargaining table.
Mm-hmm. One other big issue is that the UAW has been facing this corruption investigation involving missing union funds. How much clout does the UAW have right now?
That is another good question to ask. When the union made the announcement that they were going to go on strike yesterday, the union president did not attend that news conference, partly in part because he probably didn't want to answer questions about the FBI raiding his home last month. Mm. So that definitely has an effect. Now, whether it will have a substantial effect, it's not completely clear. Here on the line, on the picket line, the word is solidarity. No one's questioning the leadership at this point. They're all agreeing that what the union stands for right now is getting better pay, better benefits, and more job security for the workers.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody joins us from the picket line at GM's truck assembly plant in Flint, Michigan. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tanya Mosley, broadcasting today from Tempe, Arizona, where migration, as you can imagine, is a major story. Reporters here at KJZZ's Fronteras Desk have produced a remarkable series tracking the journey that migrants take from Central America to the United States. Seven journalists from across seven locations, from Honduras and Guatemala to the borders of Mexico and the U.S. cities of Phoenix and Portland, Maine. We're taking a look at some of those stories now. Here's Jorge Valencia reporting from San Pedro Sula, Honduras.
One of the key transit points in Honduras is a busy city called San Pedro Sula. People sit in traffic during rush hour. They shop in street markets and malls. It's hot and humid. Roughly 700,000 people live here.
My name is Sonia.
Sonia Maritza Hernandez is one of those people. She's showing me the fruit she's growing in her yard. Bananas, limes, oranges.
Naranja agria. Hay limón. Tenemos plátano.
Her vegetable garden is an important sustenance for her, her partner, and her two daughters. She stays at home, and her partner, a mechanic, finds work only once in a while. We look for work, she says, and we can't find it.
Buscamos trabajo, no teníamos.
There are multiple reasons why people are migrating from Honduras, and they're all connected. There's an unstable government, organized crime, and poverty. According to the World Bank, almost two-thirds of Hondurans live in poverty. Even people with steady jobs struggle to pay bills. That's the case for a man named Jose, who makes T-shirts in a factory for Under Armour. We're now using his name because he fears for his safety. He and his wife both work there and bring in about $650 per month. He shows me his energy bill. It came in at about $100. The water was another $25. Jose and his wife have two daughters, and by the end of the month, those $650 are long gone. Since April, teachers have been throwing tires across major highways and setting them on fire to protest what they say is the chronic underfunding of public schools. Jorge Barahona is a teacher in a high school just outside San Pedro Sula. Listen, he says, there are people who have no job, no home, and are getting desperate. And so the entire family migrates, Barahona says. He squints, and he covers his nose with his fist. He holds back tears and says, it's painful. He lost an entire classroom's worth of students to migration last year. He says the country is losing an entire generation. This is an exodus that can be traced back by at least a decade. In 2009, the Honduran military took down the president in a coup d'etat.
Mi nombre es José Manuel Zelaya Rosales.
This is the man they took down, former democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya. He and many outside observers say the takeover had support from the U.S.
Yo creo que los extranjeros
Zelaya says he believes foreign governments and businesses take advantage of corruption in Latin American countries so they can exploit them.
Para doblarle la espina dorsal, el modelo económico les ayuda.
Honduras has been in turmoil since Zelaya's removal. The country's homicide rate skyrocketed, and for the past decade has had one of the highest homicide rates in the world outside of a war zone, according to the United Nations Office on Drug and Crime. And current president Juan Orlando Hernandez is at the center of a U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration investigation connecting him to drug trafficking and money laundering. Protesters in a recent march chant "Out with Jo," referring to the current president. In the meantime, many are still trying to leave the country. Sonia Hernandez, the mother with the vegetable garden, migrated north with her daughters and her partner this year. But they were deported by Mexican officials almost as soon as they got there. Here in San Pedro Sula, they live in a one-room house with no running water.
Tal vez no es un palacio, pero yo cuando vine a mi casa yo me sentí la mujer más feliz de la vida.
It might not be a palace, she says, but when I came home, I was the happiest woman alive. Jose, the man who works at an Under Armour factory, says he knows migrating is dangerous, but so is living here. We're talking in his living room at about 10 p.m., and he says at this time, it's too dangerous to leave the house. Right now, all I can do is take a shower and watch TV, Jose says. Large swaths of the city are controlled by rivaling gangs, and it's easy to get caught in the crossfire. I've seen many, too many of my friends die, Jose says. He says his brother lives in Miami, and he'll try to join him there. Jose stares into the darkness of the street. He says he'd rather die trying to give his daughters a better life than to stay and die here. For Here Now, I'm Jorge Valencia in San Pedro Sula, Honduras.
And let's bring in KJZZ's Fronteras desk editor, Michel Marisco, who helped put this all together. Michel, the U.S. Border Patrol says 64,000 migrants were either apprehended or turned away from the border last month. And that's actually down 56% from May, when agents said they were overwhelmed by their jobs. Are these U.S. policies really deterring people from trying to move north?
People were definitely discouraged. You know, one of our stories in this series was in Guadalajara, where people had given up on the American dream and had instead turned to a Mexican version of that. I would point out that this is also a season where migration has traditionally declined. August and July are hot. And what we have seen in the past years is that migration tends to pick up in the spring, which it did this past year as well, and then start to drop off again and then start to increase again once the heat waves pass.
You were reporting in Yuma, Arizona, where crews are working on building more border fencing. Here's Border Patrol spokesman Jose Garibay.
There are areas that we've identified that are close to population centers, such as San Luis, Arizona, where we have a need for the 30-foot variant of the new replacement wall. But as we get out into the desert, there are areas that it is only 18 feet. But that's because we've identified the locations where we need the tallest wall as quickly as possible.
Michel, what can you tell us about the wall construction in this area? Is it just replacing that old wall, or is there a new wall that the president can point to as a campaign promise fulfilled?
Right. It's a great question. So there's two types of wall there currently. One of them is not a wall at all. It's a vehicle barrier. It's about 3-4 feet high. It's welded steel on rails of steel X's. It's meant to stop cars, but it's easy to climb or over. The other one, of course, is that old landing mat platform that the Clinton administration initially put up, right? Both of those are being replaced with this 30-foot high bollard style wall with an anti-scaling panel at the top, buried, 6 to 10 feet in the ground. All of that is currently taking place. As far as what they're putting up new, it's almost become a semantics argument for people. Because what's going in new is replacing the vehicle barrier. That is definitely new. Replacing the old Vietnam War landing mat platform, that's not new.
Your perspective in this series is from migrants, but we know that Arizona is still a conservative state. What's your sense of how important this issue is to people who aren't directly impacted by migration and border issues?
As always, you know, there's going to be people who are not directly impacted. And yeah, Arizona has tended to lean Republican. People here stepped up. People in Pima County, which is a blue county, Maricopa County, you know, people stepped up to help these migrants because there were so many of them that Immigration and Customs Enforcement have been dropping people off outside of a Greyhound bus station without any recourse or resources. It wasn't strictly blue voters who went out. There were people from many different walks of life who were going out and trying to lend a hand to these folks. That's one indication that, you know, again, this is something everyone's discussing. As far as impacts, this isn't a question of illegal immigration from the 2000s, where people, you know, had several dozens of people every night crossing through their land. This is a much quieter form of mass migration, even though the numbers are still really high.
Michel, you've been reporting along the border for many years here in Arizona, including for this series. From your view, how has it changed?
So one of the major changes is that this was a large population of people who wanted to be captured. You know, and for years, undocumented immigrants through the U.S. Had wanted to evade apprehension, but you know, the Border Patrol was the last people that they wanted to see. Now they're the first. That's one of the challenges that the Trump administration has been facing. The plan now is literally to just keep people out so they have nobody to ask asylum from unless they approach them at a port of entry. And then even that's very regulated now and metered. That is one of the largest changes that we've seen. You know, in 2000, at the absolute height of undocumented immigration here through Arizona, we had a population the size of, Alaska that came through the state and all trying to avoid capture. Now we had a population that was significantly less than that. You know, that was 500,000, but now wanting to turn themselves over to federal agents. That's a major distinction.
That's KJZZ's Fronteras Desk editor, Michel Marisco. He and a team of reporters just wrapped up a series called Tracing the Migrant's Journey, which spans 7 locations from Honduras to Portland, Maine. We'll hear more this week, and we'll link you to the series at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Michel, for lending this perspective.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Colorado is heaven for fly fishermen. Saw many recently on the Green River. Are you picturing men and their waders snapping a line back and forth? Well, 2 female guides are working to change that picture. Allison Borden of Colorado Public Radio reports.
You want a nice kind of soft J shape from the tip of the rod down to the fly line.
Caitlin Boyer stands on the bank of the South Catamount Reservoir in Colorado Springs. She's showing Lauren McKenzie how to cast a line with a steady, rhythmic whip.
The reason we call this angling is that beautiful arc in the rod.
It's almost silent, aside from the light swish of a rod and the buzz of flies, except when you catch a fish.
Oh, set! Yes!
It's a trout, about 1 foot long.
He has gorgeous spots.
Boyer calls it a lovely game of tug-of-war.
There's just nothing quite like having a bite and like fighting a fish and landing it.
Boyer is a certified fly fishing guide, but some clients can't see past the fact that she's a woman. One time, a man found out he was paired with her and tried to back out of the tour. Boyer convinced him to give it a chance.
You know, I took him out, and when I was doing my demo, I caught a really nice fish on my first cast and netted it and showed it to him. And he was like, oh, well, if we're catching fish like that all day, then I'm going to be happy. And I'm like, yeah, you will be happy.
When Boyer got certified at Colorado Mountain College, she was the only woman in the course. The next year, the course again had just one woman, Robin Schmidt.
if I were to change anything about the program, that was it, that I wouldn't be the only woman. I mean, it was a little lonely.
Schmidt and Boyer bonded over that loneliness. They saw more women getting into fly fishing, and yet...
just in this region, there's only probably a handful of female guides.
Boyer thinks women are more comfortable learning from other women. She says clients tell her they wouldn't have booked tours with male guides.
Male guides, a lot of them, their whole thing is kind of tough love. They yell at you a lot. You're constantly being scolded.
So Boyer and Schmidt created a scholarship for women at Colorado Mountain College and raised money to fund it. This spring, they awarded three women with scholarship packages. Mark Cole helped create the guide program.
This year's class, the 2019 class, 75% of the class was women.
As more women get involved, the industry has taken note. Rachel Leinweber manages Angler's Covey in Colorado Springs. It's a cavernous fly shop with live bait, boat rentals, and all of the gear. This year, there's some new gear made specifically for women.
Coming out in fall, we have our first wader with a zipper. Men have had that for so long, so where they can easily relieve themselves.
Leinweber has been fishing her entire life, but admits...
we do still have an uphill battle.
Just recently, she stopped into another fly shop.
They got quiet, stopped talking, and just stared at me. And then one of them was like, hey, you've been fly fishing before? And just assumed I didn't know anything.
Back on the banks of the South Catamount Reservoir, Lauren McKenzie is thrilled about landing a trout.
In 7 years I've lived in Colorado, doing regular conventional fishing, I don't think I ever caught a fish. That might be my first Colorado fish ever.
Fish on the fly, yep.
Yeah!
McKenzie's now looking to buy some used gear and plans to go fly fishing with Caitlin Boyer again sometime this year. For Here and Now, I'm Allison Borden.
Next week, the UN Climate Summit opens in New York. This week, Here and Now is taking part in a collaboration of news outlets around the world to ramp up coverage. It's called Covering Climate Now.
This is kind of the new normal.
Which is more intense storms.
Expect intense tropical cyclones to become more frequent.
This is a global problem.
And temperatures have dried out Sao Paulo's Cantareira.
We'll be looking at many aspects of the climate crisis, but we begin today with something on a lot of young people's minds, whether or not to have children. In the UK, there's a group called the Birth Strikers, women and men choosing not to have children, not because they think it will help reverse climate change, but because they're petrified to bring children into a world that will almost certainly be 2, more likely 3 or 4 degrees Celsius hotter in the coming decades. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made waves on Instagram after she raised the question in a video earlier this year.
There's scientific consensus that the lives of children are going to be very difficult, and it does lead, I think, young people to have a legitimate question. You know, is it okay to still have children?
Our next guest is asking that question. 27-year-old Ali Sarusi is on a solo road trip from Seattle cross country to grad school. Lots of time to think. And Ali, you say you're leaning toward not having children because of climate change. Why?
Thank you for having me here, Robin. First of all, one of the things we hear a lot about is it's predicted that we have about a decade to switch to renewable energy to kind of keep the effects of a changing climate manageable. And that's terrifying to me. I'm 27 years old right now, and I'm about to go to graduate school. If I think about maybe I'd want to have a baby when I'm 31 or 32, and that's about 4 or 5 years from now, to think that that kid could be 5 and to know that we haven't switched to renewables is just heartbreaking to me.
Well, and explain why. You say that there was a moment your mom's friend posted, "Losing Earth, the decade we almost stopped climate change." This was a New York Times article. Tell us about reading that.
So it was pretty late at night. It was about a year ago. And I was kind of scrolling through Facebook, avoiding going to sleep. And I saw her post about this article. And my entire body went cold when I read it. And I started to understand it wasn't just, you know, trash in the ocean. It wasn't just melting ice. It was really about a livable future. Well, and that was a lot for me to take in.
Well, it's also something that could have been stopped. This is the article by Nathaniel Rich in 2018, and he writes about how from 1979 to 89, we as a culture understood climate change just as well as we do today. There was scientific consensus. There was political consensus. The fossil fuel industry really didn't start to mislead the public about what they knew until the late 1980s. Republicans like Senators John Chafee and Robert Stafford were on board. Everybody thought that this was such an important thing to reverse this coming climate crisis. And then it just wasn't done. Is that part of where your blood ran a little cold?
Some of that, but also what would happen to the Earth at certain degrees of warming. You know, with 2 degrees, we'll have these things happen. With 3 degrees, these things will happen. And, you know, as the degrees increase, effects are more disastrous. And that's what really got me.
Yeah. 3 degree warming forests in the Arctic and the loss of most coastal cities, 4 degrees, Europe in permanent drought, vast areas of China, India, Bangladesh claimed by desert, Polynesia swallowed by the sea. You sent this article to a friend. What did she say?
She replied and she said, thank you for sending it to me, but I just want to let you know that climate change is a huge trigger for me and I'm having a hard time with sleeping. And, you know, it's hard to receive these messages and these articles late at night when I'm trying to get some rest because this is such an intense and anxiety provoking topic.
Mm. So you have a friend who's using the word triggering. You know, this is something that is really gripping people your age. How mm-hmm. are you picturing this future? I mean, when you think about it, you've told us that, you know, you cry in baby stores.
As I'm picturing it now, I worry that kind of on the minor end of things that if I had a kid and, you know, it would be hard in the summer, like maybe there would be too much smoke from wildfires, which was an issue in Seattle last summer. And then that would maybe decrease their quality of life. That's kind of the smaller things I think about. And then I think about what if there's wars? What if we're fighting a war, wars for resources? Like, that's really scary. And I would have to find my child shelter because of climate change.
Well,
which people might be doing now.
In parts of the world. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can hear people saying, though, and maybe they've said to you, there have been other doomsday predictions. In the 60s, Stanford biologist Paul Ehrlich predicted the collapse of civilization because of overpopulation by 1985. His 1968 book was The Population Bomb. I mean, people took it seriously. There was the film Soylent Green, which was based on another dystopian book about no food. There's not, wasn't going to be enough food for people. Well, 1985 came and went. And, you know, we learned to engineer high-yield crops in the so-called Green Revolution. Do you hold out hope that humans will come up with some solution and then maybe you'll regret having made, if you make the decision not to have children?
Well, I do think about that sometimes. I also think that there's many ways to have a family, and it doesn't necessarily mean having one biologically or, you know, it could mean adopting, it could mean foster care. And I also kind of think of extended family, like extended community family. Like, I have friends with kids. I'm on a sports team and I'm, you know, part of a great community of people on the sports team who have kids. And I don't necessarily think that my decision is one that everyone should be making. I think it's something that is highly personal. And that's the choice I've kind of made for myself right now.
Have you read David Wallace Wells' The Uninhabitable Earth?
No, but I believe it's on my list.
Yeah, well, it might push you over the edge because we'll link people to our interview with him. But, you know, he's one of those who does document if we don't avoid 2 degrees of global warming, 153 million people will die from air pollution alone. I mean, it's just disastrous, the scenario he lays out. It's apocalyptic, an impact twice as big as the Great Depression, and it could be permanent. But he also has just had a child. And, you know, he writes that without children, we lose our will to fight for a future. And also, children are emerging as some of the most potent forces against climate change. You know, we think of Greta Thunberg.
Yes.
So
My hero.
Yes, the young woman who's advocating for really doing something about the climate crisis. But doesn't he have a point there? Here's the guy who wrote the most disastrous book of recent memory about the effects of the climate crisis, but he has hope, and part of his hope comes through having a child.
I don't think I could really argue that, because I think the decision, I mean, even if you pull the climate crisis away and, you know, it doesn't exist anymore, I think the decision to have children or not is one that each person, family, couple needs to make on their own. So, but like I said before, like there's people in my life that I care about that have children. And I also just, part of general altruism, care about people and children. And so it, you know, they do give me hope, but it's not necessarily to say that I feel like I could have my own.
I mean, it is paralyzing sometimes for parents to think of things that they're, that might be a danger to their child. You know, often some parents say, I'm not going to think about it, you know, because everything from cars in the street to something they might pick up and drink. But this is such an apocalyptic future. I'm wondering, if, you know, how sad it makes you to think of the world we might be delivering to children.
It makes me really, really sad. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and there's so many beautiful places across the world, but I am biased towards the Pacific Northwest. And going on this trip has shown me the natural and cultural beauty of this country. And it's painful to think about that we could be losing a lot of that to environmental destruction and climate change.
And delivering that to little ones. Yeah,
exactly.
Ali Sarusi, 27 years old. She's from Seattle, Washington. On a cross-country drive, she stopped in Santa Fe, and she's right now leaning towards maybe not having children because of the climate crisis. Ali, good luck to you on your decision and the road trip. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And again, this story and others this week are part of Covering Climate Now, a collaboration of more than 250 news outlets around the world. So are you considering being a birth striker? Maybe you already are one. Or do you see children as a sign of hope? Weigh in, hereandnow.org.
Companies in California have until January 1st to prepare for the state's new regulations on freelance and contract workers. Governor Gavin Newsom is expected to sign that bill. And it's been widely reported that this law will have a big impact on companies like Uber and Lyft. But we also wanted to understand its impact on other industries like trucking, cleaning companies, even news organizations. And to break all of this down, we have with us Derek Thompson. He is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us as he does every Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
So we've been talking a lot about Uber and Lyft, but can you give us some specific examples of other companies that fall under this bill?
Sure. So you're right. The headlines about this new law really did mostly focus on Uber and Lyft and food delivery companies like DoorDash. But that could be just the tip of the iceberg. Other companies that rely on a freelance or independent workforce include trucking companies, media publishers mm-hmm. like The Atlantic, janitorial companies, software developers. And so I would summarize the debate like this. On the one hand, there are people who want to be independent workers or who thrive mm-hmm. as independent workers, either on a full-time basis or part-time basis, and they don't want their livelihoods outlawed by any state law. But then on the other hand, there's a lot of people classified as independent workers, like, say, janitors, who don't have the economic power or the protections that come from national labor law. And so I think there's a lot of people in California and across the country, really, who want to establish new state laws that can protect people who are being abused by large, powerful corporations.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the long list of businesses that are not exempt from this law, that are not included here. We've been talking a lot about Uber, Lyft, and then you brought up some of those others. But there are also other folks like hair salon, hairstylists, and other folks who are not part of this law.
Yes, the exemptions are a huge part of this story. So just taking a small step back, it's important to understand that the main function of this law that we're talking about was not to invent an independent contractor law from scratch. It was to codify and reconcile a court ruling, Dynamics versus the Superior Court of Los Angeles. And that court established a test, essentially, to determine if a worker should be classified as a contractor who doesn't deserve, you know, wages and labor market protections. Now, what much of this law delivered was exemptions to that court test. So doctors get an exemption, psychologists get an exemption, podiatrists, real estate agents, certain industries and occupations that have occupational licensing, like hairstylists, they got an exemption. So what we're seeing right now is, in fact, the process of carving out exemptions. And indeed, Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash are essentially saying, okay, if we couldn't get an exemption from the law that's about to be signed by the governor, maybe we can encourage California voters to force the state to exempt us. And that's exactly what's happening right now. They're spending tens of millions of dollars to hopefully create a statewide ballot whereby voters in the state can essentially say, you also need to exempt the ride-hailing companies as well.
Got it. Well, until that happens, though, how are these companies calculating all of this? Are they going to be forced to classify workers? And then what happens after that? Do they hire then fewer workers?
That's exactly what's going to happen. So if the courts do rule that AB 5 applies to Uber, you're going to see major changes in the way that this company operates, in the way that Lyft operates and DoorDash. They could, for example, be more inclined to treat their workers as employees. That means benefits. It means higher wages. That sounds like good stuff. But it also means acting like a boss and not just a platform. It might, for example, mean that the way that Uber and Lyft would work is that the companies wouldn't just create a digital platform for these drivers. It would instruct them when they can and cannot work. It would make it illegal, potentially, to drive for both Uber and Lyft, as many of these riders already do, or many of these drivers already do. And so in the big picture, I think it would eliminate a lot of the efficiencies and conveniences that consumers seem to love about the platform, while at the same time clearly doing something to protect these workers. That's why I think this isn't an issue where I come down on one side or the other saying, oh, clearly one side is right. I think this is a really thorny issue precisely because the convenience economy has created this new class of labor.
And very quickly, you brought up earlier the workers who perhaps don't want to be classified as employees because they're afraid of losing their flexibility. Is that likely to happen to those workers?
I don't know. This is a great question, something that I'm really looking at for the next 6 months or a year. How are drivers going to respond to AB 5? How are they going to say, or what are they going to say in terms of whether or not they want to continue to be able to work for lots of these companies at the same time versus trading that flexibility for a relationship with one company so that they can get wages and labor protections from that company, even though it might make their work for the company less convenient?
Right. There's a lot to follow here. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.